The Sunstone Foundation presents Go Ye Into All the World to Convert or to Serve, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Go Ye Into All the World to Convert or to Serve. It's sponsored by Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. I'm Linda Newell. I'm co-editor of Dialogue with my husband, Jack Newell. I'm requested that I remind you that these sessions are being recorded, that it's a copyright recording, and that done only with the permission of the participants, and we're asking you not to record privately. We'll follow. I'm going to introduce the panel participants first. We'll start with Lowell Bennion, move to Marjorie Whitman, and then Louise Weldner. Most of you, I don't think, need an introduction to Lowell Bennion, particularly if you subscribe to Sunstone, because they did a cover story on him a few issues back called A Saint for All Seasons, and those of us who have known and loved and admired Lowell loved reading the article, and I'm sure that the rest of you will too if you pick it up after the session or whenever. Lowell is the son of a prominent Utah educator, Milton Bennion. Brother Bennion has devoted the greater part of his life to education. He received his B.A. from the University of Utah in 1928 and his doctorate from the University of Strasbourg in 1933. He also studied at the University of Washington and University of Arizona. Dr. Bennion in turn shared his learning with students as director of the Salt Lake LDS Institute from 1934 to 1962. As associate dean of students and professor of sociology at the University of Utah from 1962 to 1972. And in numerous books, manuals, and articles for the LDS Church, including The Religion of the Latter-day Saints, Teachings of the New Testament, Religion and the Pursuit of Truth, and his most recent book, I believe, The Things That Matter Most, but not his last book. But he's given much more than food for the mind. He's spent a lifetime revealing the physical, emotional, and social hungers of those in need. For 25 years, he's owned and operated the Boys Ranch in the Teton Country in Idaho, and I think this is the first year in 25 years that ranch has not been operable. He served on many boards and committees, including the Salt Lake Association of Retarded Citizens, the Salt Lake Commission on Youth, Shriners Hospital Volunteer Board, and the Human Resources Council. He's currently serving as director of the Community Services Council. He also had time to be an LDS bishop for 3 years, as well as a husband and father. He's married to Merle Colton, and they are the parents of 4 sons and 1 daughter. Marjorie Whitman, I feel like I've known all my life. I've known her all my married life. That's, 23 years? We first met Dale and Margie when Dale Whitman was in law school at Duke University and my husband Jack was getting his master's in history at Duke and served on the MIA board. For 1 year, we lived in the same town, and we've never lived in the same town since, but we have managed to stay close enough to each other to will our children to each other and to meet in strange places like Junction City, Kansas, when we were traveling in opposite directions across the U.S. at the same time, and to keep see each other at least annually over these 23 years. So Marjorie is truly a sister to me in many, many ways, and I'm very pleased to have her today on the program. She's a convert to the church. She grew up in Salem, Oregon. Dale's responsible for her conversion. As he served a mission there. She's a graduated from BYU in 1963 with a B.S. in sociology. She married Dale in 1962 and in 1970 a registered nurse, going back to school with 4 daughters still at home. And then went back and had two more children, and plus an Indian foster child, and then later adopted two Laotian refugee daughters. She was patient education coordinator at the Utah Valley Hospital, diabetes educator in Seattle, Washington, and now in Columbia, Missouri, she is an oncology nurse at the Ellis Fitchell State Cancer Center in Columbia, Missouri. She's also the state primary president in the state primary presidency at this time. Louise Widener, it was born and raised in Salt Lake. She is a graduate of the University of Utah. She has a bachelor degree in anthropology with emphasis in French and Arabic. She has a bachelor's in psychology, a master's of science in public health, and her PhD in anthropology with emphasis in third world health development. She's done research pertaining to this to her doctorate degree in Egypt, and currently is an associate instructor in the School of Medicine in the Department of Family and Community Medicine. Louise is married with 16-month-old twin boy, a boy and a girl, twins. And with that, those introductions, we will turn the time over to Lowell Banion.
That applause is for you, Linda. I'd like to try to lay a religious foundation for what, for the point of view I'm going to take on whether to serve or to convert. There are various ways of being religious. I think of five basic, we call them dimensions of religiosity in sociology. One is by reason of what we know. Some people feel religious because they're theologians or scriptorians or experts in church history. The second way is by what we believe, by the beliefs that are peculiar to our particular faith, gives us a feeling of being religious. Third way is by our participation in the church, in ordinances and ritual of the church, corporate worship, church activity, teaching, proselyting, things of that kind. In fact, LDS people are prone to almost identify the religious life with church life. The fourth way is by our personal relationship to deity, to the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And the fifth way is, I call it our relationship to fellow men and to ourselves, the morality, if you will, personal and social morality. These five ways of being religious, I think, are all valid and meaningful, can be, and be supportive of one another. But all of these five ways of being religious have no meaning unless they're accompanied by justice and mercy in human relationships. And I'm going to illustrate that for you. The writing prophets of the Old Testament, Amos, Hosea, Micah, Isaiah, and Jeremiah. If you don't know these men, you don't know religion. These are great thinkers and expounders of the religious life, but they reject every other expression of religion if it's not accompanied by justice and mercy in human relationships. Let me give you a few illustrations. Amos was the first of these writing prophets, lived about 760 B.C. in northern Israel. He said, I despise your feast days. He talks for God. These men have the audacity to speak for God in the first person. I despise your feast days. I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Though you offer me burnt offerings, I will not accept them. Neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs, for I will not hear the melody of thy violas. But let justice run down as waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. In the next chapter, Amos said, woe unto them that are at ease in Zion, that lie upon beds of ivory and stretch themselves upon their couches and eat the lambs out of the flock and the calves out of the midst of the stall, the very best of meat, if you will, that chant to the sound of the viola and invent to themselves instruments of music like David, that drink wine in bowls, not in cocktail glasses, but in bowls, and anoint themselves with the chief ointments, but they are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. They're not grieved for the affliction of their fellow human beings, fellow Israelites. One of the great chapters in prophetic literature is Isaiah chapter 1. If you'll read that at your leisure, you'll get the whole gamut of prophetic feeling at its best. Isaiah, in a powerful statement, rejected the religious life of ancient Israel and Judah. In place of burnt offerings and songs and prayers and holy days, Israel was told to, quote, learn to do well, seek justice, relieve the oppressed, judge the fatherless, plead for the widow. And the prophet Micah summarized great religion in these beautiful words. He said, wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Isn't that beautiful language? Human sacrifice. He has showed thee, O man, and what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. Jesus, consistent with the prophetic emphasis, said, by this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one for another. His last words to Peter after the resurrection were, feed my sheep, feed my lambs, feed my sheep. And of course you all know Paul's eulogy on love. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. I find in the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants the same essential emphasis on mercy and compassion for fellow human beings. In Doctrine and Covenants 52:40, I read, and remember in all things the poor and the needy, the sick and afflicted. For he that doeth not these things, the same is not my disciples. Boy, I sit up when I read that and wonder if I'm a disciple. Remember in all things the poor and the needy, the sick and afflicted. For he that doeth not these things, the same is not my disciple. Well, what are the implications of this emphasis in both the prophetic work and the New Testament? I would restate the title of our panel. Instead of saying, go ye into all the world to convert or to serve, I would say, go ye into all the world to serve and to convert. I don't know why you have to make a choice between those two. The heart of our Christian faith is to love God by loving our neighbor. I'm concerned that we don't balance and back up our proselyting efforts with a greater emphasis on service, both in word and in deed, both within the church and in society at large. For example, there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of elderly people, mostly women in Salt Lake Valley, living below the federal poverty level of $600 a month, who are without spouse or children, who face the disabilities of old age and death alone. They need their yards cleaned, their houses repaired and painted. They need, above all, to know that somebody cares. We meet hundreds of elderly people in Salt Lake Valley who face life absolutely alone and who are living on $300 or $400 a month of Social Security. If able-bodied Latter-day Saints, young and mature, would commit one half a day a month to service, we could transform our town and create a feeling of goodwill and brotherhood beyond your imagination. What I wouldn't give for a Mormon volunteer corps of 500 who would give joyfully and faithfully a half a day a month to me. I could also use 500 families who were anxious to build friendships with a lonely, elderly, or disabled person on an ongoing basis. I would like to see, in the spirit of the Doctrine and Covenants, Section 88, more time in study in priesthood, relief society, and Sunday school manuals spent studying the problems which face mankind: war and peace, crime, poverty, human rights, child abuse, unemployment. What might our Christian faith contribute to the reduction of these social problems? These are complex, difficult issues. I'm not so naive to believe that we as a church can solve the problems of mankind. What we might do, however, is develop some pilot projects which might demonstrate some solutions. Some church farms, for example, could be a wonderful setting for senior citizen living or a place to redeem alienated youths. The church is committed to take its message to all the world. I believe this can be done most effectively if it is the message of a people who are living a Christian life of service towards one another in the fold and towards people not of our faith. I believe Christian living would attract and draw people to it. Maybe someday we will send missionaries out to serve and to teach. The results would bear watching. Go ye into all the world to serve and to convert. Thank you.
It was worth the trip here from Missouri just to hear Dr. Binion. I attended the BYU Women's Conference in March, and one of the speakers there was Louise Durham. Louise sat among wives of general authorities, and when she rose to speak, she said, "I know you didn't come to hear a BA/homemaker. I feel somewhat the same way. I'm not as credentialed academically as the two other panel members. But I've not had my eyes closed as I've gone through these 40-some years, and I've learned to appreciate on the panel and hopefully learn lessons from them. Going into all the world to serve others on an individual basis is an opportunity for creative, thoughtful expression. Service can occur both as part of organizational efforts or on our own initiative. If our service is given as a member of an organization, our behavior is seen to represent the group's goals and somewhat diminishes the intimacy of the one-to-one caring. Of course, there's great need for both, but my remarks are focused on person-to-person service. Service is labor given for the benefit of others, and there always lurks a cynic eager to point out that all human behavior is motivated by self-interest. In reality, I think most behavior is multi-motivated and very complex. We would have a difficult task if we attempted to explain our own behaviors with a single motive. I find it very confusing to sort out the issue of motivation and much prefer to operate from the philosophy I learned in the BYU nursing program, which simply states that people do the best they are capable of at a given time. And I personally sense an interest in most people in service, in serving others. As the title of the panel suggests, we have to question, whom shall I serve? And the parable of the Good Samaritan is so easy to draw from, to remind us that the boundaries are not within our religious organization exclusively. But as a child, I personally experienced another philosophy that I believe operates in the world too, and that is that service is given for show. It's given to raise our esteem in the eyes of others. And I personally was often grieved because my father spent a lot of time entertaining and giving lavish gifts to members not of his own family, while my mother struggled very hard to raise our family. So when I learned about the church, I was very excited by the idea of taking care of your own first and having a stewardship of your own family. And I just wanted to share that part of my background. I'm not at all naive in thinking that we must not confine our service to our own families, but I think there are a lot of people whose families are given short shrift and the public gets the larger portion of the person's service. There are four guidelines for serving others I would like to suggest, and of course these are not meant to be all-inclusive. But first, service should be for the benefit of those served. Second, it should be appropriate for the situation. Third, the beliefs of the individual should be respected and supported. And finally, some remedy for the underlying cause of the problem should be identified and initiated if possible. And I'll elaborate on these. About service being for the benefit of those served, perhaps the only people who can successfully serve in a way that might not be deemed for the benefit of the served are parents. And we even have a hard time pulling that off. We are usually better off if we convince our children it truly is for their benefit, that we are giving them some service. But no matter how well-meaning an unwanted effort may offend, I recall with embarrassment an incident that occurred among the Mayan ruins in eastern Mexico. As tourists, my friend and I were striding toward an ancient pyramid when we were greeted by two elderly women. Without hesitation, one of them offered, "You know, we have a Book of Mormon which explains the origin of these ruins." Her thoughts were certainly consistent with mine. But my friend quickly realized or felt that that was a very impolite gesture. Unasked, without concern for the privacy of our thoughts, the woman simply intruded her helpful information. Of course, no harm was done, but a wall instead of a bridge might have been erected. So whether the labor involves a listening ear or bringing in food or some other offering, it should be for the benefit of that person, and I believe it's helpful if it's with the consent of that person. As far as the service being appropriate, it just goes without saying that help isn't help unless it's appropriate. And that necessitates an assessment of the needs. On this highly populated planet, people achieve a surprising amount of privacy. They're usually reluctant to advertise their problems, and it often happens that we are unaware of the fact that they have a need, much less the precise nature of the service they need. Hence, we're often misled into giving a wholly inappropriate and unhelpful form of help. And apparently this is an age-old problem, because that expression, taking coals to Newcastle, has been around a long time. A rather hard-nosed assessment of what is needed is vital. When we were living in Orem, Utah, I would sometimes hear that when a mother was hospitalized, a family needed no help if there were teenage children in the home. It seemed obvious to me that one could appropriately call out the National Guard for those situations. Help would mean sending the kids out for pizza and cleaning the house, which was being trashed several times a day. Making an appropriate assessment of need is often more difficult when the beneficiary of our service is a non-Mormon. The church is often, or sometimes anyway, criticized for focusing its welfare and service efforts on its own people and neglecting its non-Mormon neighbors. This may be a very valid observation, but it's frequently difficult to learn what our non-Mormon friends need. Church members are accustomed to a pattern of behavior in which one makes candid and even intimate disclosures to the bishop or the home teachers. This makes an assessment of needs relatively simple. Non-Mormons don't operate under these same assumptions, and it can make it more difficult, but not impossible, to be truly helpful. The third thing that we should keep in mind is to respect the beliefs when we engage in person-to-person service. Usually, one-to-one service without being part of an organization is what I would call crisis intervention. By that, I refer to a situation of acute need which can be attended briefly so that the individual can then seek more elaborate helping system or resume self-care. In this setting, I consider it very inappropriate to even suggest that the individual's worldview might not be adequate for the occasion. And let me be specific. 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, and one of the attempted supports I received was a large outpouring or a large reception of information on Christian healing. While I appreciated the concern that motivated my born-again friends to provide this information, I think it was inappropriate because it was not timely. In a time of crisis, individuals need increased faith in their familiar coping style, not the imposition of a new technique. It comes at the wrong time. In a crisis, the best approach is assisting the individual to identify methods that he or she has used successfully in the past for surviving other crises. And service in a time of crisis, then, should be given in a manner which supports the person's belief system or their already developed coping style. And then fourth, to look to long-term solutions. The best form of service, we're taught, is to teach a person to fish, not just to supply the fish. We want to help avoid future problems. If the problem is somewhat self-imposed and unpleasant by the individual, we might cautiously discuss with her ways to prevent its recurrence. For example, you may be the person to let a friend know that caffeine increases the pain and size of fibrocystic breast disease. As Latter-day Saints, we can share specific and appropriate truths without imposing the whole package on people. We also should look for truth beyond the sphere of Mormon society. For example, spacing one's children is not a traditional Mormon doctrine. But I have often boldly expressed sincere gratitude for my washer, my dryer, and my contraceptives. And I have wondered how many of my peers I liberated from untimely pregnancies. Probably the greatest service we can give is personal concern. If the service delivers a product which the person does not want or need, we've missed the mark. There are times when food is needed, but equally times when it is not. Love is always appropriate. Love which says to another, "You are of worth. Your life is valuable to me, and I will stay with you even though the quality of your life deteriorates." It is such a great opportunity to work as a nurse. I think we need to be qualified to give the help we might want to give, and the more qualified we are, sometimes the more appropriate help we can give. It is such a privilege to work with people who've been diagnosed with cancer. And believe it or not, most people cope very well with cancer. We sometimes have the feeling that only within our own religious beliefs do people cope well, and everyone beyond that sphere is just falling apart when they face life-threatening situations. But the cancer center I work in was primarily for indigent people, and it's only recently been open to private patients. And these people, who should be coping most poorly of all because of their low economic status, cope very well with the trials and the rigors of cancer and its treatment and its eventual death and grief. And that's something we all need more courage and opportunity to deal with, maybe, is to deal with the reality of declining life. We're aware that in our society we shut the ill and the elderly away into institutions where we don't have to notice them when we go shopping for fine things. And it is such a privilege to work with these people and enter their lives. I think we all need to be Mother Teresa's. She's a model of openness, willingness to be vulnerable to work and pain and stress. Are her motives selfish? I hope so. I hope she lies down at night with a peaceful conscience that she is part of the solution to life's problems, not part of the cause.
The title of this panel, "Go Ye Unto All the World to Convert or to Serve," and the question mark coming after "serve" makes clear reference to the missionary program. And the moral implications, at least I interpret it that way, and the moral implications of the disproportionate number of proselyting missionaries to what we may refer to as service missionaries. I've been asked to address this issue when it comes to the matter of international service, no doubt in response to the fact that there's a great deal of pain and suffering in the world, and that the missionary program provides a great resource for able-bodied, willing volunteers. This is an issue that is very important to me and of great personal relevance because of the things that I've seen in my work, especially in Morocco and Egypt, and the pain and suffering that does exist. As a result, you may be a little surprised on my stand on the subject. It's quite simple. I reject outright that the provision of international service should be a primary objective of the missionary program at this point. This is for three reasons. First of all, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the only organization that exists whereby a directed, organized proselyting effort can take place. On the other hand, individuals interested in serving at the international level have a number of organizations that we can go to. We can go to WHO, we can go to UNICEF, we can go to foundations that exist right here in Salt Lake that whose charter is toward international development and health. We have a lot of options that don't necessarily that aren't necessarily limited, and yet again, the church is limited to the church itself to do proselyting. We can't go to the Jehovah Witnesses and ask them to do it. We can't go to the WHO and ask them to do it. Based on this fact, I think it's reasonable that the missionary program focus on an activity that only the church can ask its members to do. Another reason that I reject the notion of the missionary program as primarily a vehicle for international service has to do with the unique nature of the mission experience. And this relates to some of the scriptures that Brother Benyon has expressed to us. Whether it be a proselyting or service mission, the mission experience is still a relatively short, intense, unique experience. And it's not expected to continue in its nature past the duration of the mission. On the other hand, the provision of service, whether it be internationally, locally, personally, is a lifelong commitment. It is a matter of personal, spiritual, and philosophical orientation. And so, though missions of all types are, of all types within the church, are certainly of benefit, we can't infer from them that the attitude of service and the provision of service is a one-shot deal. The third reason for which I reject the mission/service concept as a potential major direction for the church, at least at this point, has to do with the ultimate impacts of that scenario on the quality and quantity of service eventually rendered at the international level. This is not in any way to cast aspersions on the missionary program. The point is there are 5.5 million members of the church not on missions, and there are only 28,000 or so who are. The vast majority of the 5.5 million who are not, whom I know, for example, don't take very seriously the directive every member a missionary because they know there's an established program to take care of missionary work. As someone who has seen, to a very small extent, the serious problems that exist internationally, I can promise you we can't risk that same attitude take place after the church has developed an international program for international service. Next thing we know, it may be that we just shift that responsibility to the organizational level and forget about it. I promise you that the prospect of the 5.5 million eventually catching the vision of the need for international service and finding their own way to appropriately meet those needs is much more appealing than anything that 28,000 can do in a 2-year period. I'd rather wait for the former. If I sound a little bit negative, I assure you that it's only intentional. I think that our self-inflicted organizational dependence has already reared its ugly head. It has revealed to us that we are part of a cycle that is negative and that needs to be broken. The cycle begins with our selective perception that if we do what we are asked, we're doing enough. This, again, is a direct result of our organizational dependency. This false assumption has manifested in a number of ways. Take, for example, the fast offering. This is meant to be a law of minimums, and it is an issue about which the church is remarkably non-authoritative and allows us to exercise our personal discretion in. And yet, if we pay our fast offering, we feel that we've done all that we need to do. And if they're not asking for war, they must not need it. As organizational dependents, we assume that it's enough. This brings us to the second part of the cycle. We haven't been told to give more, so it must not be needed. In other words, we have to be told everything. If we haven't heard it from the church that a special need exists, then it must not exist. I think that this was manifested beautifully in the Ethiopian case. We managed to outwait our leaders. We waited until they organized a church-wide fast, got us all together, pampered us, and got us to send our dollars in. Fasts should have been called in homes, neighborhoods, and wards long before, years before, for a number of reasons. The enormous amount of money raised no doubt hurt very few of us and could be done routinely. Depending on the situation, the issue, somewhere in this cycle, we begin to equate a sense of belonging with a sense of service. No doubt the thrill for many of sending a check to the Ethiopian cause was related to the feeling of being part of a larger effort which would receive a great deal of recognition, and the feeling that feeding the Ethiopians was at the time the thing to do. The problem is that feeding the starving has always been the thing to do. We just don't do it. Finally, somewhere in this cycle, we begin to snowball our effect. As an anthropologist by training, I'm always very interested to watch the social interactions that take place in predominantly LDS neighborhoods. Our organizational dependency tends to manifest itself in our social interactions until we find ourselves not only gravitating toward Mormons, but then eventually toward Mormons of our own socioeconomic strata. The problem with this is we eventually begin to have a warped perception of reality and necessity. Eventually, we have members of stakes who think that tennis courts are necessary for their stakes because those tennis courts will provide a context for family interaction. This warped sense of perception is very serious when you consider the fact that there are stakes and wards in this very city that are struggling to just feed their members. And we also forget that caring for the needs of the needy is also a context for family interaction. It doesn't have to be playing tennis. The cycle continues and we become less and less aware of more and more. Or is it more and more aware of less and less? Anyway, we spiral downward. How can this cycle be broken? I believe we have to start with knowledge. Knowledge is power, and in this case, our knowledge of the situations of the worlds around us give us power over our own ability to act. For example, very frequently there are articles in the paper regarding the United Nations Water Supply and Sanitation Decade. If we force ourselves to read past the first line and not move along to the funnies, we might find that the water-related issues that the UN decade is devoted to have relevance to, for example, the Ethiopian case. The water decade focuses on improving access of water for irrigation in the arid regions of the world. It also focuses on providing water suitable for drinking to the 85% of the world inhabitants who do not have such access. It focuses on reducing the 40,000 daily deaths due to pediatric diarrhea resulting from impure water. Further reading of this article might indicate that despite the hundreds of millions of dollars spent so far on the decade, and we're midway through, we're actually falling behind. Daily deaths due to pediatric diarrhea at the beginning of the decade were only 25,000. Now they're 40,000. Socioeconomic development in many areas is actually slowing due to a decrease of manpower from water-related diseases and famine-induced hunger. Professionals working with the complex problems of the UN Water Decade have abandoned the original goal of fresh water for all by 1990. We now only hope to reduce the speed with which we fall behind. The point of all of this is that we must first become aware. Who can hear these statistics and not at some level be touched by the problems and the magnitude of the problems that exist? Awareness is the first step. The second step is that of dedication. What is needed in the international arena is dedication. A flash in the pan do-gooder is, in many ways, worse than no help at all. Their zeal is often spurious and overwhelms their sensitivity and the patience and introspection that is required for appropriate sensitive action. This dedication comes from maturity. I have no idea how that can be achieved, although I'm open to suggestions. It also comes from a spiritual wakefulness, which has characterized all of the great servers with whom I've had the pleasure of working and who I have known. I have not at all touched upon the many needs for service at the international arena, nor upon the many ways that service can be rendered. I think that those who have truly internalized the concept and the feeling of attending to needs will find an outlet for their intentions and compassion, and that outlet will be appropriate for them, their families, and the needs with which they're concerned. I also believe that a discussion of the opportunities that exist for international service might be a little bit premature right now, because we have a long way to go before we even have a desire to meet those needs. It's critical that we first realize that the responsibility for service lies with each of us, as does the responsibility to determine the manner in which the Lord would have us do our part. This goes for international service as well. Let's stop relying on the church to come out with programs, to come out with ideas, to come out with directives. My own hunch is that the Lord may have deliberately let matters of international service continue to be outside the mainstream of the church's focus thus far, for the simple reason that true service at the international level is often dirty, disgusting, depressing, but always ennobling. Perhaps he's waiting for us to reap the ennobling benefits for ourselves that accompany the process whereby curiosity turns to awareness, which turns to activity and anxious engagement. Let me just add extemporaneously a comment that has more relevance to the community level. Although I've been talking about international service, we have international problems right here. Salt Lake has the second highest refugee to native population ratio in the nation. We have got over 8,000 Indo-Chinese refugees. The needs of these people are incredible. I've worked with the refugee board, and they are starving to death. Many of them have frozen in the winters. You know, the problems are tremendous. We don't need to think, well, international service would mean that I pack up and go to Timbuktu with the family and, you know, the kids might get sick. I mean, it's not that kind of thing. We can find opportunities for service. Another thing is that we might be a little more careful in how we spend our money, not just at the personal level, but at the ward level. My husband boycotted the Christmas party last year because there were $3,000 spent on the decorations. This is a disgrace. I'm sorry, but that is very much a disgrace when you consider that this is a Christmas party. We're celebrating the birth of Christ, yet he was a man of sorrows. He was acquainted with grief. And his spirit, I think, was down with the portal of refugees who were starving that night and cold that night than, you know, on the east side of the Christmas party. So all we need to do is complain. You know, all we need to do is somebody needs to jump in and say, no, this is inappropriate. Let's not do it. And just be a little more vocal in our feelings. Thank you.
We now have the session actually can go till 12:30 if you want to go that long with your questions, but we do have time for questions from the audience directed at the panel members. So, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then please direct your question to whoever you want to answer it.
Two questions. The first to Lowell, but he can comment on the second question also. The first question is, I'm intrigued by the fact that there are old people and that need love and that need their houses painted in the Salt Lake Valley. And I would ask Lowell, why isn't the church, with this marvelous organization and the home teachers, doing it? Where is the breakdown that these people aren't getting the love and the help that they need? The second question is a little more fundamental, and I ask it to Lowell and the other panel members. Respond to the argument that conversion to the principles of the gospel of Jesus Christ, not to the church, not to the ritual, not to the ordinances, but to the principles of the gospel of Jesus Christ, that conversion to those principles would be the greatest service that we could do to our fellow human beings. Maybe some of that conversion needs to take place in the Salt Lake Valley, but respond to those two.
I think the first question is, why don't we, through our present church organization, home teachers, serve the people in need in the community? I don't know, unless it is that we talk about religion, that satisfies us. I go to a high priest's meeting every Sunday morning, and we talk about the same things we've talked about before, and we're not motivated to get out and do anything. I really think that we've come to identify too much the religious life with church talk and church life and church activity, instead of using a church to motivate us to get out and do something, to live the gospel. If I understood the second question, I think we're prone in missionary work to convert people to the restoration and to the church and the things that are peculiar to our faith. I meant to say that if we were living the fundamental Christian gospel of the Beatitudes, love, humility, if we were really realizing this Christian life as a body of people, and we would try to convert people to principles rather than to the institution, I think that'd be a great direction to go. And we couldn't do that unless we were exemplifying, experiencing, feeling, acting out our basic Christian faith. If we were living a Christian life, excuse me, some people are, but if we were as a body of people really living the Christian life, then I think we could be more successful in converting people to it, and that'd be the greatest blessing we could bring to mankind.
I think the idea that the greatest thing we can do is convert people to the principles of the gospel is probably true, but there always comes a matter of timing. In the first place, people are not in a position to accept anything that we might be able to construe as a stressful situation, and certainly a change in philosophy and ideology is, unless basics in health and shelter and food have been met. For this reason, I think that needs to be an initial focus, just meeting the basics. The other thing, again, also relates to timing. For example, in Egypt, we don't run out and grab the Muslims and drag them off to the Red Sea and baptize them, because there is a very sticky political situation right there where the Coptic Christians and the Muslims are always fighting, and this keeps Egypt on the brink of a revolution. All that is not needed is another faction going in there and stirring things up. And I think that the church as an organization is sensitive to this issue. So it's not really a question in my mind of whether or not the principles of the gospel are the best service. Certainly they are, but it's a matter of sequence and the point at which they're provided.
I would like to just make one. I think in your first question, you assume innate in that was the assumption that these people are Mormon, all of them. We don't have, they're not, are they?
No.
And we don't have a very good track record of reaching out beyond our own. Are there other questions? Yes, in the back. Did you all hear the question?
Yeah. How to modify the missionary system to put a greater emphasis on service. By the way, I've quit giving the church suggestions and recommendations. I think we're doing some of that now. For example, we've sent health missionaries to Hong Kong. I've known a couple who've gone there and have been nurses. They were nurses who served the people of Hong Kong. I think we might try some of those experimentally. We might go into Bolivia and take a group of capable missionaries that might teach them how to better farm, or take medical missionaries in and meet the very fundamental needs of people for food or medical care, and do it just as human beings, not for the purpose of proselyting. After we serve people and meet their needs, they say, "Why are you here?" Well, we love you. We have faith in God. We have faith in Christ. This is our way of life. Demonstrate one way or another to some act of service. Maybe agriculturally, maybe medically, maybe some other way. Educationally. We're toying with the idea. Well, I'll skip that. The Community Services Council where I work, it's not LDS, it's non-sectarian. We're thinking of going to Nigeria with the medical sanitation program, very carefully initiated, using university medical people and Intermountain Health people to try to meet the basic health needs of some of the health needs of the Nigerian people. I think the church could do something like that in some area. Pilot project, a demonstration. Seventh-day Adventists have established a hospital here and there, and I don't know that they combine it with proselyting. I'd like to see us just serve for service's sake. Let proselyting come about with questions later on.
I know that question was for Dr. Binion, but I'd kind of like to respond to this issue too. We have two daughters on missions right now, and I'm so grateful they're not trying to solve the problems of the world. A 19-year-old is, well, you know, you've heard that if the church weren't true, the missionaries would have ruined it a long time ago. And there are things they can do, but I really feel concerned about that, because I think that these young people, that is just part of their growth and development of becoming independent. And it is a very careful school for them, and it's all that supervision is very important. I worry both of our daughters, one's in Canada, one's in Ohio, are spending some time at local hospitals, and that just makes me so nervous. I don't want ill people preyed upon by missionaries. So I think we have got to send a loud and clear message, like Brother Benya suggests, that if we're going to serve, we've got to serve with no strings attached. I think that the church is a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ, and we learn as we serve each other about serving. But there is nowhere written that we have to limit it to members of the church. And by example, in our homes, if we don't live in a total LDS neighborhood, we can actually become acquainted with non-LDS elderly people or ill people or young people. There are a lot of needs, and they're not just confined to the ill and the elderly. There's depression among young Mormon women. And I'd be very reluctant to see all the structure thrown out the window. I think maybe one of the problems of recent years is that changing our schedule, I see all the benefits for it. I'd even like it changed a little more. But I'm concerned about the support group that we were to each other as young married women. And that support group has largely disappeared during the week. And I think we need to take care of our own needs very carefully and spread out family to family, like Louise mentioned, and not just become an upfront acute mission to some foreign country. There are so many urgencies. I guess that's the thing. I agree with Brother Binion. There are urgent needs, but there are so many urgencies, and we can't turn our back on any of them, and I don't think 19-year-olds are going to solve those problems.
If I'm not mistaken, that question also had pertinence to the curriculum of the church in general. And my estimation is that, again, it comes back to education. I think that the Relief Society could be a marvelous source of person power, women power, to addressing these problems, but it's not rising to the occasion. I was recently in Relief Society. I have to admit that when it comes to Day Relief Society, I don't make it very often. I feel like I'm at a club, and I don't really have time for that. But I did break down and attend the homemaking class. And instead of a situation wherein we had someone like the refugees or a group like that up teaching them how to make a home in this setting, I mean, these people often don't even know how to use the currency to go buy food. The basic homemaking things, you know, and learning homemaking tips from them, this kind of thing. Instead, we had a woman demonstrating how to make Easter bread. Everyone there knows how to make bread. We've seen it a billion times before, just this year. And, you know, it's beating a dead horse. We're all well-fed. I didn't look around and see anybody who wasn't well-fed. We all know how to eat bread. We know how to make bread. We know how to can our goods. We're beating it now. We need to move on and extend ourselves. And I'm finding that at least in the area that I live in, the Relief Society has become a day club where the women come dressed to the nines and they're, you know, with their sculptured... Oh, here I go. But their sculptured nails teach each other how to make little bunnies out of bread. You know, this is a disgrace. It just really is, considering the needs that exist in the community. It's a resource that's not being tapped.
Your other question? In the back, yes.
I got that one by default. but I think that that should be intuitively obvious, even though it isn't. Elder Pullman, about, what's it, how long ago was it? It was about, was it been 2 years? Has it been 2 years now as of October? Gave an excellent discourse on the fact that we, in conference, that we need to learn to live without direction. Anyway, that's the point. He's right. We do. We need to take hold of ourselves. And I think that that's the basic message of the gospel. And so maybe what there needs to be is more of an emphasis on learning the gospel itself before we can come to understand that. But I don't know, you know, I don't know if we can really get the church to disown responsibility for this, because at the same time it is also an organizational responsibility. Probably can't. I'll let you take it. I don't have an answer for that.
You can do it by example. We don't have to have edicts. We have to have examples. And I'm sorry if your name doesn't show up in the paper, if your example's only with your neighbor down the block. That's enough.
Are there other questions? Yes. Would you like to
respond? If you're on an airplane going east, you can ask your next door neighbor if he ever heard of the Mormons. Would you like to know more? But in Salt Lake, in Mormon communities, I agree with you. It's not wise. It's not gracious. It's not a favor to anybody to start out a relationship with those questions or to refer neighbors to missionaries. I believe the best thing in the world to do is what you're trying to do, to live the gospel in a very genuine way, build relationships. And if they want to ask questions about us, then that's the time to develop our ideas with them or teach them. I may be wrong in that, but I just can't. I work with a lot of non-Mormons in my daily work, and I don't ask any of them if they'd like to know more. I try to treat them with respect and respect their views, and if they want to inquire, they can inquire of me. I may be wrong. I feel like you do, brother.
I'd just like to step out of my role as moderator for a second and make a comment about an experience I had on an airplane once that Lowell's comment reminded me of. I was coming back from the East, and my seatmate was a middle-aged man who was coming from some large Eastern corporation to Utah to interview business graduates for his company. And so I asked him why, if he came often here or if this was one of many places he went. And he said that his company was particularly interested in Mormons. You've all heard this story, too, in your sacrament meetings. But his company is particularly interested in Mormons because, you know, they don't smoke and drink. They're honest. They're this, they're that, and the other. And he went on and just built up these Mormon young people. And they understand obedience and to authority and these kinds of things. Then I asked him another question. I said, "Are you a Mormon?" And there was dead silence, and that man was trapped, and he knew it. He was telling me a story that he wanted me to go back and tell all of in sacrament meeting. And he finally admitted that he was, and he didn't know that I was the point. So I think that that our zeal for so many years that every member of missionary has sometimes far exceeded appropriateness or even what is ethical, and also an invasion of privacy. And I think the best missionary tool that any member of the church has is an exemplary life. And I think that the people on this panel and many of you in this audience are serving that kind of a mission without ever having to offend anyone to do it. There was a question in this area over here. Yes, ma'am.
It seemed to me as I was listening to the panel, one of my own observations as well, I wonder if we are in effect not reaping what we have sowed in the emphasis we have placed on obedience over agency. Earlier in my life, when there was more, and I used this term with a great deal of trepidation, a more liberal trend in church thinking, it seemed to me at least, as an observer, that the emphasis was more on agency. Now it has seemed to me that the trend has distinctly been on obedience. And if we preach obedience pretty slowly, long enough, should we really be surprised if we have reaped a generation that waits for someone to direct us, if we have not lost some of our innovativeness, some of our initiative, because we are waiting for the state president or the bishop or the central brethren to tell us precisely what to do?
I'm not sure that needs a comment from the panel. Would anyone like to comment on that?
Okay. Tell an experience I had with David O. McKay. He came to see us one day at the Institute of Religion, and on the way out to his car, he said, "Who was that on the TV with you and Sterling McMurrin last Sunday?" I said, "It was Jack Adamson." He said, "Is he a Mormon?" And I said, "Oh, yes, he was on a mission in Scotland, and very fine Latter-day Saint." I said, "But he's very independent in his thinking." David O. smiled, and he said, "Nothing wrong with that, is there?" You know, there was an age I grew up with, a generation back. David O. McKay, Hubie Brown, Joseph F. Merrill, John A. Witzel, Albert E. Bowen, Stephen L. Richards. Those men had a lot of respect for thinking, for free agency. I felt free to discuss anything with David O. McKay. I had some wonderful talks with him about evolution, about the black issue, and about birth control and some other things, and found him just as open-minded as anybody. I think there's a tendency towards more conformity today and less independence of thinking in the church. I agree with you.
The only fallacy that I can see in that line of thinking is that Yes, we are in a trend of obedience, and there is a great deal of direction relative to what we can do and should do. The problem is that the matter of obedience, to my knowledge, is only a ceiling on the level of sinful or bad things that we can do, but there's no ceiling on the types of things that we can do that are good. My bishop might call me in if he finds that I'm carousing. He won't find that, but he would call me in if he found that. But he wouldn't call me in if he found that I was giving more than 10% or giving more to the fast offering. So yeah, there is an issue of obedience, but that obedience, theoretically, you know, there's a floor to the sin, but there's not a floor to the good.
I might just remind you that at this same hour in the Empire Room on Saturday, Dialogue is sponsoring another panel that deals with the question of obedience. So some of you may want to pick that one up too. Are there other questions? Yes.
It seems to me that what I've heard mostly today is the concern of the fact that we are tasked, we're not doing what we should be doing. I have one other concern here. I live in a state where we have found living within our borders in the last few years a group of people who profess a religion that we find very strange. They live a communal type life. They all dress alike, wearing red robes and so forth. They have sexual practices that we find strange and offensive. They have moved into a community, and because of their large numbers compared to the smallness of the population of the community, they've taken over the government of the community. They are strange. I don't understand much about them. My concern is, however, that I look at them and I look at our own history and I see many similarities. But yet I go to church, and people whom I would hope would be tolerant of them, and at least wanting to find out if they are sincere, hoping they're sincere, are totally intolerant. They're the first ones saying, let's get rid of them, let's do whatever we have to do to get them out of the state. And this is alarming to me. I'm not convinced myself that they're totally sincere, but I am concerned about the fact that we heard earlier today that probably we will see Mormonism becoming a major world religion. I'm concerned when that happens, are we going to become the type of people that we have, are we going to do the things that to other people that we have had done to us? And I don't know. I don't know if that's a question, but I would be interested in hearing your comments on that.
I should be wiser than to rise to that question. I think we need to teach tolerance to our people. But on the other hand, I think if somebody is undermining the social life of a community, that one can also take issue with the group and not hate them, but disagree with their practices. So I don't think we have to tolerate every practice and every philosophy and every idea among us. I think we should tolerate people, but not their thinking. There are occasions to disagree and take issue. I don't know what their practices are that you referred to, but bad sexual practices that are offensive and this sort of thing. I knew I shouldn't have stood up. Thank you.
Why don't we take one more question and then break for lunch? Back in the corner.
Two afternoons a week, say, or a Relief Society mini class is willing to reach out to the needs in our community with refugees or whatever. How specifically can I get in touch with someone so I know how to match up the manpower with the needs?
Where do you live? If it's in the Salt Lake area, call the Community Services Council or call me and I'll match you with the need. I think you need to tie in with some responsible organization. Of course, the bishop of your ward ought to know the needs in-house. And I find there are a lot of needs unmet in our own community, in our own church community. I'll see you after a meeting.
Also, the Tolstoy Foundation here in Salt Lake and a number of other churches can set you up to sponsor a refugee family. There are hundreds of families that come in, and maybe 1 in 20 will have another family sponsor them. And again, I caution you, there are a lot of Mormons who go in and sponsor with the immediate idea of conversion. That is not their need. They need to know how to use the money, how to go to a bank, how to buy food, how to use the public transportation. But all of those kinds of things can be found also in the Yellow Pages and in the blue section of the telephone book. Thank you very much, and thank you to our panel.